And here's Howard.
Thank you, Mike. That was nearly like I wrote it for you. My name is Howard, and I'm an alcoholic. My participation in preparing this history day was to call Clancy and ask him to come in and pick him up at the airport and try to spend some time with him, and that has worked out very, very well. That was as good. That is the best. You can't hear me. See, I was thinking that if the sound system wasn't going to work, now would be the time for the sound system not to work. So I was asked, and I was asked far enough back that I thought, I've got an idea for a history talk that I'd like to give. And what I did was say, yes, I will do this, and generally what it would be about. And then, you guys won't believe this, I procrastinated on organizing my thoughts and getting the thing put together. The idea is that Bill Wilson wrote the big book and Bill Wilson wrote the steps. And then he had 15 years experience of himself and others in AA of getting sober, working the steps, but yet bringing into their sober life problems and difficulties that they had when they were drinking. And Bill's experience of this led him to writing 12 essays to expand and deepen the meaning and the application of the steps in our lives in sobriety to address those problems that come with us, in addition to addressing the problems of getting sober. When I came to AA, I came to a group in West Los Angeles or in Culver City, called a studio group, in which it was a spin-off from the Cecil Hotel meeting that Clancy mentioned in his talk. And these people claim to be big book people. Now, some of the things I learned... Okay, now, for those of you who think Howard cannot tell any part of his story without the baby elephant story, I'm going to prove you're right. When I was a kid, I went to a travelogue movie on training wild elephants in India. And in this movie, they took the baby elephants out of the herd, and they began their training by putting a rope around their right front leg and snubbing them up to a big tree. And the little elephant would pull and tug and pull and tug and push and do everything it could to get loose until its experience taught it to come to believe that when that rope is tight, it's futile to pull. Now, once they learned that, they went through the rest of their training, always reinforcing. The trainer always reinforced this belief on the elephant that when the rope is tight, it's futile to pull. So that at the end of the movie, they had a big elephant who was pushing trees over. And the guys would come and trim the limbs off the trees. Then they'd hook the tree up to the elephant's harness, and it would pull the tree out of the forest for harvest. But at the lunch break, when they wanted to hold the elephant, where they wanted to hold the elephant, they put a rope around his right front leg. They drove a relatively short stake deep enough in the ground that when they wrapped the end of the rope, the other end of the rope around that stake, and the elephant moved around, whenever he would come to the end of the rope, he'd stop. They had him. Now, the stake didn't hold the elephant. The rope didn't hold the elephant. The limiting belief that had been imposed on him when he was a baby and reinforced through his life was what held the elephant. And after hearing a talk in an AA meeting one night on the way home, I thought about that, and I realized I came in here with a jillion baby elephant beliefs that I didn't even know I had. And that is applicable to my talk today only because the baby elephant belief system, I don't think ever stops. And if you're 39 years old and you know nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous, and you come in, and there are authorities within your group who tell you stuff, you believe them. And the group I came into prided itself on being a big book group. And some of these old timers would share things like the first 164 pages of the big book is all you need. A guy who died sober with 54 years of sobriety and who I always was fond of and him of me, when in my first week got me aside to tell me, stay away from the 12 and 12. Bill was deeply depressed when he wrote the 12 and 12. Bill wrote the 12 and 12 to make money. Bill was deeply into psychiatry when he wrote the 12 and 12. And then later, he was deep into experimental drugs to help him with his depression. Stay away from the 12 and 12. Now, not only did Chuck E., who was the senior guy, tell me that, but Leo H., who had a, they were both 20 years sober, and Leo told me the same thing. Leo told me, just work the first and the 12 steps. That's all you need. Stay away from those in the middle. That'll get you drunk. Well, I'm telling you, on your first night, that's not bad information. Because you've got plenty to be worried about, and to get that reassurance, that's a big help. So, but anyway, what this talk, disorganized as it is, has turned out to be is a little history, a little AA history on how Bill came to write the 12 and 12, and then a little of his story, which you're sick of hearing, but my story, his story on my experience with when I finally got into, after I had worked the steps from the big book, after I had studied him and gone through the Joe and Charlie Razu and then I got into the 12 and 12. And it helped me after I was 9 years sober. I was 9 years sober before that happened. And if I have a point to make today, it is you don't have to wait 9 years to do that. Only if you are very stubborn. Can you wait 9 years? But you look for stubborn people, and I was one of them. I had, now, as far as that group's knowledge on the Big Book was concerned, in retrospect, it was primarily from page 59 and 60, and, you know, what we read and how it works was basically what those old-timers knew. I mean, they had, I suppose, read the book, because occasionally they would quote things that gave them a basis for rationalization, but they didn't really get it. Not, you know, anyway, that, if you see, if I'd have prepared to talk, I wouldn't have said that last thing. But it was my experience. So I kind of work from the Big Book, the first half of the first step. And then after a period of time, I did an inventory. And it turned out to be a life-changing experience. Doing that first inventory when I was less than a year sober changed my attitude about my father, changed my attitude about a lot of things that needed to be changed. Now, I know it says half measures will avail us nothing, but I did half of the first step, and I did a good fourth step, and it changed my life. I had shameful things in my experience when I was 6 years old, in the sixth grade. And I had the guilt and the remorse and the shame. I wasn't going to put that in my inventory, but I did. But I wasn't going to sure as hell put it in my fifth step. But when I sat down with my sponsor, I said, how do you want to start? And he said, let's start with the stuff you've decided not to tell me. And I told him those shameful things. And I'll just tell you my experience is those things went back to the sixth grader. And they no longer haunted me. So these, just working the first half of the first step and the fourth and the fifth and skipping the sixth and the seventh, but having your sponsor track down the stuff you had stolen, having your wife borrow money and take it back. Now, that was very difficult to do, but the payoff was as good as the first drink. When I got out of that, the good feeling I had was similar to the good feeling I got from my first drink. That's just the truth. Now, people talk about prayer and meditation. People talk about prayer, and I tell them, well, I don't pray. And I want to tell them why, and they don't care. Nobody cares. But it's important that they know, it's important to me that they know that I know prayer don't work. And I told this guy, Frank Giroux, that I didn't pray. And I told him why. I went to the Methodist church, the Baptist church, the Quaker church, looking for whatever it is you can find there. I missed the Lutheran church, so I was handicapped by that. But when I was in the Navy, I went to the Catholic church and studied the catechism in order to be converted into the Catholicism. Well, right there, they do not teach you in detail in the Methodist, Baptist, and Quaker church what they teach you in the Catholic church. what they taught me in the Catholic Church was the details of the Christian belief, which gave me a basis to be free from that idea altogether. They want me to believe that. You know, what? And so I became an atheist. And then when I was in college, I announced my atheism, and my sister said, well, I knew you was going to be an atheist because you're studying science. All scientists are atheists. Look at Dr. Einstein. Well, Dr. Einstein was one of my intellectual heroes. Not that I understood what he understood, but I understood he understood things you cannot understand. That was clear to me. And so if he's an atheist, I don't need a stronger soul to support my atheism. And I read this little book by him, in which I become convinced that he believes in God. Well, if Dr. Einstein believes in God, I am not an atheist either. If he's not an atheist, I'm not. Well, it turns out he kind of fits in a category which philosophy classes teach us is called deism. And it's one where God has created the universe. And inherent in the universe is immutable laws of nature. And everything conforms to the requirements of those laws. And they are immutable, and prayer doesn't affect them. And God does not participate personally in our lives. Now, man evolved through these laws to a level of intelligence that he can understand poorly God's principles and develop technology to implement those and keep it simple. With that, man created civilization. God didn't. So if my life is going to work, I have to make my life work myself in this civilization. I have to make it work. And I explained that to Frank. And Frank said, now that's the reason I don't pray. Do you understand that? And he said, I never learned to pray until I learned to meditate. What is meditation? And Frank said, well, you can go to the Bodhi tree and get 1,000 books on meditation, but if you got the 12 and 12, Chapter 11 is the best description of meditation that I know of for members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you read that? Well, that was at our home group meeting on Friday night. I read that step carefully in the 12 and 12 the next day and called Frank and said to him, that's the St. Francis of Assisi prayer. That's just what I am not going to do. And he said, is that all you got out of that? I said, that's all there is in it. And he invited me and my daughter and wife to come over to their house Sunday morning. And he and I sat at his kitchen table, and he took me through Step 11 of the 12 and 12. Now, I'm not going to take you through it sentence by sentence and word by word the way he did me, but I'm going to make some points. The first sentence is, prayer and meditation are our principal means of conscious contact with God. And if you're interested in the possibility of having a conscious contact with God, perhaps you don't want to skip our principal means of doing this. On page 98, there is a direct linkage among self-examination, meditation, and prayer. Taken separately, these practices can bring much relief and benefit, but when they are logically related and interwoven, the result is an unshakable foundation for life. Now and then, we may be granted a glimpse of that ultimate reality, which is God's kingdom. And we will be comforted and assured that our own destiny in that realm will be secure for so long as we try, however faltingly, to find and do the will of our Creator. Then on page 99, he said, well, we start like this. And then he said, instead of the St. Francis of Assisi prayer, which you're not going to do, let's look at the first of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous with self-examination, meditation, and prayer. Let's see how we can do the first step using that approach. As beginners in meditation, we might now reread this several times very slowly, savoring each word and trying to take in the deep meaning of each phrase and idea. Many times people who are talking about meditation say, meditation and prayer say, well, meditation is listening to God. Prayer is talking to God. If that turns you on, perhaps just keeping in mind the elements of the first step in your mind and listen or be open to any deeper meaning about that that can come to you. And then he talked to me about there's nothing. Oh, it will help if we can drop all resistance to what our friend said. For in meditation, debate has no place. We rest quietly with the thoughts of someone who knows so that we may experience and learn. There's nothing the matter with constructive imagination. All sound achievement rests upon it. Meditation is like that too. It helps to envision our spiritual objective before we try to move toward it. Now, I'll stop reading. I was nearly a year sober. And Frank says, what is an alcoholic? Okay, the first step. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and a dash. And I remember the first time I heard Clancy talk about the first step. He talked about the dash as a punctuation mark, which means now I'm going to a new thought. Or it also means, if you look at a dictionary, the dash sometimes replaces words that have already been said and that you don't repeat. But that's obviously what the dash means. So it might be we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. We admitted our lives had become unmanageable. But it's two different thoughts, two different ideas. What is an alcoholic? Let's look at the first part of it. What is an alcoholic? Well, hell, I knew that. Alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control their drinking because they have an insane, obsessive belief each time they start to drink that somehow, some way, this time, it's going to be different. This time I'm going to baby a half a pint through the day, starting at 6 o'clock in the morning. And coupled with that obsessive belief is a physical reaction that manifests itself in the phenomenon of craving. And over any considerable period of time, that gets worse, never better. And the first step is to fully concede to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic. That is our first step in recovery. And then he said, do you remember your first drink? Can you visualize that occasion? And I could. Let's find where in your drinking history you reached the place where you had a drink and you knew if you had another one, you were running a high risk of being in trouble, and you had it anyway. And then when you started drinking to function, and finally when you ended your drinking in pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I was able to visualize each one of those. In the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization phase, I was demoted. My wife was leaving me. I was $2,500 in debt with no hope of any money coming in to pay it. So I was also had stolen some equipment owned by the federal government with the hopes of getting money to pay the $2,500. They took off with the equipment. I still had the debt and now the crime. And I'm a candidate for a hard time in the federal penitentiary, and I think I'm pitifully and incomprehensibly demoralized. And in my self-examination of that, I can, in my consciousness, fully concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. And Frank said, while you're there, know that if you ever get the bright idea to drink again, that that's where you're going to start. With the pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and it's going to get worse. It's never going to get better. So I kind of was able to do that. Now, he also said, okay, what has happened since you came to AA? You've been in AA about a year. What has happened? Well, one of the things that he knew that had happened was a guy that used to work for me called me and said he had a consulting job for me that paid $2,500. He would work around my regular job. He would pay my expenses. You know, and I got the 2005. It wasn't a happy occasion because my wife had big ideas about that 2500 that weren't applicable because I had these other things that had to be done. But it got paid. I had done a fourth step, and my sponsor tracked down the equipment, and I took it back, and I felt good. My wife and I were getting along, and things were better at work. Now, Frank said, while you are being conscious of those things that have happened, he said, don't make stuff up. Don't con yourself. Make it real stuff that you're imagining or focusing on. And he said, if in that process you feel gratitude, now he said, listen to me. This is not a cup. And he raised his cup of coffee. This is not a table. And this isn't a chair, because cup, table, and chair are words. And these things are not words. Thank you is just words. If you're feeling gratitude, hold that feeling. And he said, if a good feeling starts right above your ankles and your shins and starts coming up your body and goosebumps come out on your hand, that's my higher power saying, I felt your gratitude and you're welcome. Let that be the way you pray. Don't ask God to do anything else for you. Just look to see what has been happening in your life from the program. And if you feel grateful, let that be your prayer. Now, I'm here to tell you that was a significant thing in my life, which came to me through Frank Giroux and through the 12 and 12. Somehow, I didn't put it together that Leo and Chuck and some of the others were probably wrong about what they were saying about the 12 and 12. But I started doing this thing, and then I wouldn't do it. And then I'd start to do it because I'd be in trouble. I'd be backed up into a corner, and then in the 12 and 12, somebody showed me the sentence in step 7 that sooner or later we have to stop using our higher power as some kind of a Bush League pinch hitter. And I knew I was doing that when I was skipping my meditation. And on the 1st of October, 1974, when I had over 2 years, I made a commitment to meditate for 30 minutes a day, every day for the rest of my life. And for essentially 30 years, I kept that commitment. There was no time that I knowingly didn't spend that 30 minutes. It was a significant thing in my life to do. And when I was 5 years sober, I worked the first half of the first step. I worked the fourth step and the fifth step. And I worked the eighth and the ninth step. And to some extent, the 10th and the 11th and the 12th step. And my life got progressively better. My life was working. If you would have said, "Are you happy?" I would have said, "Yes, I'm happy. I got a good, hell, I'm getting asked to speak at meetings. And I'm getting more and more, you know," he says, "a host of friends." That's just the truth. And people like Jack Bailey, a celebrity, was my sponsor, and he lifted me up all the time. The first time I heard Clancy talk at the break, okay, it was a two-speaker meeting. I read chapter 5. There was a first speaker at the break. Clancy came up and told, and hell, I'm a man making a successful living in the engineering field. And Clancy came up and said, "Howard, you did a great job on chapter 5. You know, I needed that. That was a tremendous thing. And 35 years later, or 34 years later, I still get lifted up by it. My life was working and good things were happening. But if you'd said, "Well, are you really happy?" I would have said, "No, not exactly, because once I achieve my goal, I will be happy." In August of 1981, on my ninth birthday, that next week, I achieved my goal. I was promoted to manager, technical section of the systems engineering department. And within 3 days, life was more dreadful than it had been at any time up to then. And I had a meditative experience that it basically implied. It was a frozen lake experience. I ain't going to go through all of it, but the metaphor was walking across the frozen lake is a good metaphor for living your life a day at a time. Walking across the lake a step at a time is the metaphor. But be careful because it's slippery. And by the way, if you're not absolutely convinced that the ice is thick enough to support you, you're going to dread every step you take. Now, that had a special meaning to me. I had had other experiences, but that told me I needed to come to believe, not in the God that isn't a part of life, not in the AA group, which I did believe was the higher power in my life, but in G-O-D. Now, where I got that idea about G-O-D was from the big book. And we agnostics, none of us can completely define or comprehend this power, which is God. And okay, the power, and that, you know, I was looking for the power, you know. I was looking for the power. Lack of power is my dilemma. I was looking for the power. But here in the book, it says, really, forget looking for the power. The power is God. Look for God. Be open to that. And it says on page 93, which I heard at my first meeting. They started the second half of the meeting reading, to the newcomer, whatever concept you have of God will work for you, provided it makes sense. And that impressed me because my concept of God made sense to me. Didn't make sense to you guys, but it made sense. And then the group and the steps became a power greater than myself. But the fact of the matter is, when I achieved my objective, life was dreadful. And I then, for some silly reason, I had gone through the steps in my first year and then in my fifth year. And now it's my ninth year and I'm going to go through the steps again. This time I'm going to do the second step, searching for God. And in this search, I go to the 12 and 12. 9 years sober, and I go with the 12 and 12 looking for an answer rather than knowing that all these things about Bill and on the first page of the step one, there's a line. It's an interesting line. It says, our admissions of our personal powerlessness become the bedrock upon which we can build happy and purposeful lives. Well, when I read that, there's two things I'm sure of. One is, I ain't on no bedrock. And the other is, I am not personally powerless. I personally have power. I can personally decide to pick this book up. And having decided, I can pick it up. I have power. I just don't have enough power. And once I was clear on that to myself, myself asked the question, well, or said, okay, that's right. Now decide to pick it up with your vision. Just wrap your vision around it and levitate the book up. Just the way you do with your hand. Well, I can't do that. Well, give yourself the power to do that. I can't give myself the power to do that. No, you didn't give yourself the power to decide to pick it up with your hands, or the power to pick it up with your hands. In and of yourself, you are personally powerless. Now, if I get that literally, now the idea that I get from the big book, that I should be open to the idea that God is a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, and that inherent in the spirit is the all-powerful guiding creative intelligence manifesting precise law in every aspect of all being. And if I think about that and come to believe it, then I can trust it. And I started trusting that, and my life stopped being dreadful. But I made both the steps as they're described in the big book on how to do the steps, coupled with the 12 and 12, deeper, broader description of the meaning of the steps. Now, and pass it on. I've got a whole bunch of pages marked, but we're not going to do all those. I told you that so you'd have a sense of well-being. Okay, one of the things they mention in here is Bill did have his practical side. Now, this book was written well after I came into AA and after my new baby elephant beliefs were established. But it turns out there was a guy named Ab A, who was a very wealthy Oklahoma guy in the program. Very wealthy, and he was trying to give Bill Wilson $60,000. And Bill was saying no. And in his letter to Ab, he said, "Now I'm getting down once more to serious writing. A small book will appear in the fall. This will be followed by a short history of AA. Then I expect to do a book which will cover the application of the 12 steps to the whole problem of living, the problem of happy sobriety. After that, there will come a manual on AA services. So I am beginning to get on paper our whole experience of the last dozen years. This, if successfully finished, will of course bring me substantial income. Far more substantial income dash. Far more, perhaps, than I shall ever need myself. This will mean that out of my own earnings, I shall be able to pay off my former creditors. That would, I think, set the best possible example to other AA members." That chapter started out, "Although money was never a motive for any of Bill's AA work." If you read the rest of this hit book and all the other history about Bill Wilson, that kind of supports. Also supports what Clancy said, that early in the program he would have franchised it because they had big things to do. But ultimately they decided they just had this one primary purpose, and then they didn't need all the money. He started writing as soon as the first General Service Conference had come and gone. The traditions essays came first. Indeed, much of the work on the traditions had already been done for Grapevine publication as the 12 points to assure our future. After these were finished and revised, he undertook the essays for the steps. I was talking to a friend of mine in Las Vegas, and I was telling him about the difficulty I was having getting ready for this talk, and that really I was going to make the point how Bill had tried to strengthen us on the steps. And he said, "Well, you know, it isn't certain that Bill wrote the essays in the 12 and 12. They may have been written by somebody else, and we don't know how much was written by somebody else." That was, you know, I needed that like I needed a hole in the head. Now, the makers and writers of the history of AA say, "Bill wrote a section at a time and sent it to friends and editors for their comments. Then he revised the original material according to suggestions that came in. He also used trusted AAs to help him with three projects. Betty L. worked on the 12 and 12. Tom P. on the 12 and 12, and AA Comes of Age, and Ed B. on the second edition of the big book." And in discussing with my friend in Las Vegas, once I read that paragraph, that Bill wrote each section, he said, "Well, yeah, he wrote the section and he sent it to Tom P. And Tom P. may have rewritten it himself. And Tom P. was the editor of The Grapevine, so editors can get their other thoughts in and still leave the thing looking like the original guy wrote it. I knew that. And so I was worried again about Tom P. Tom P. got mad at Bill over something, possibly the authority or credit for the book. That may be in it. And he not only resigned his job at The Grapevine, but he left AA entirely. And he started a real recovery program whose primary purpose was the arresting of all addictions. He had, he's shooting for the whole deal. The name of his AAA was All Addicts Anonymous. And he started what I would call a little commune or a little community someplace up in New York. And boy, these guys that came in here were required. Their primary purpose was no sex. Just damn near no short-term pleasures that don't address the long-term pain. And God is the only thing that really addresses the long-term pain. And until you find that, there ain't going to be no drinking, no drugging of any kind, no sex of any kind, including masturbation. I mean, it all was going by the board. I was telling this story the other night when Planet Jim was there. Some of you know Planet Jim, and he interrupted when I said this guy left AA to start his own thing, and Planet Jim's deep voice said, "Well, we didn't miss him." and I didn't. But there's another guy in AA who's a history buff who lives in Los Angeles area, in the South Bay area, J.S., and I called to talk to him. And 6 or 7 years ago, or sometime back, he went to New York and went to the commune where he did interviews where they, everything there has to be taped and recorded. And he went through that, and he talked to Tom, and Tom said, basically, I don't have any claim other than I participated in the editing of Bill's writing. I didn't write it. I was just the editor. But his anger was with this progress is an acceptable thing, where he wanted absolutes. And anyway, when Bill got the first printing, the first book of the 12 and 12, he, it may have been the very first one, he addressed to Tom P., thanking him for his participation, and without which this book would not have been possible. Gratefully, Bill W. And if you read that, you think, well, we don't know how much he could have contributed. Bill had similar inscription in a whole series of books that he sent to the people that had helped him editorialize and write the book. So I became convinced that Bill wrote the book pretty much the way it's described here, for the purpose that is described here. And it's described here in a letter to Father Dowling dated July the 17th, 1952. Quote, "The problem of the steps has been to broaden and deepen them, both for newcomers and old-timers. But the angles are so many, it's hard to shoot them rightly. We have to deal with atheists, agnostics, believers, depressives, paranoids, clergymen, psychiatrists, and all and sundry. How to widen the opening so it seems right and reasonable to enter there and at the same time avoid distractions, distortions, and the certain prejudice of all who may read. It's a fairly much an assignment. Now, when he gets done with the 12 traditions, he sends him to a guy named Jack Alexander, who had been the author of the Saturday Evening Post article that resulted in AA's rapid growth in 1941. Jack Alexander was complimentary to Bill. And then when he had the essays on the steps written, he sent those to Jack Alexander. And Jack Alexander writes, "The 12-step script is fascinating. Only trouble with your writing style is mechanical. You rely too often on the clause or the phrase set off by dashes. I started off by trying to reduce them, but I gave it up. I think you ought to have someone go through the script, seeing how many dashes thus used can be reduced to simple commas. It would make for smoother reading. The same person should remove most of your exclamation points, just to get another mechanical gimmick out of the reader's eyelashes. They are cries of woof woof, and their impact gets less with each repetition. Otherwise, the text is splendid. It has real authority and conviction, and I stayed with you to the end, which is more than I can say for Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea." Now, I've tried to make the point from AA history that Bill Wilson, who wrote the steps, Bill Wilson, who in writing the big book, who got to page 6 before he mentioned other drugs. If I'd have been thinking, I wouldn't have said that. Bill Wilson, who on page 14 wrote, as Clancy was talking, but Clancy don't have, he remembers, and "these were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound." Powerful. Wonderful experience. That paragraph, when you close the book, closes on this paragraph. "My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problem. It was fortunate, for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going." The paragraph where he describes a powerful spiritual awakening closes against a paragraph where with over a year, he's having terrible depressions, nearly drinking, angry, full of self-pity. And he finds that if he works with another, he'll recover. But that was his story, his experience. And then he saw it in many others. And so after 15 years, not to make money, I don't think, but I think his primary purpose was, as he told Father Dowling, to expand and deepen the meaning of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous without changing the 12 steps. He was just expanding and deepening them for our use in our recovery so that we could bring into our new life a sense of well-being, a sense of trust, that if we just do, you know, we got to do the steps, but if we just do this deal, our life manifests order, harmony, and unfolding goodness. He knew that. He wanted us to get it. I don't think you should have to wait 9 years. And I don't pass it on to people other than I did today that he wrote it for money or he wrote it for any other purpose. But the sooner we get into this, now that's not true of meditation. I want to, you know, what Frank did was give me a better way to work on the first step. We were really doing the first step. But until you are at the 11th step, if you're going to meditate, just get it clear in your head. You're going to focus on the dreadfulness of the life you had today, if your life was dreadful. That you'll focus on. But after you've worked the steps, then there you'll be able to focus on some goodness. After you've stayed sober and been active in AA, there will be goodness to focus on. And you'll learn how to do it by working the steps. Thank you guys very much for allowing me to talk. And we're now going to have some luscious sandwiches and whatever we're going to have. Thank you a lot.